There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly. Are your wiper blades chattering, skipping, or squeaking? Don't let streaks or smearing on your windshield compromise your visibility. When it's time to replace your wiper blades, stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts and see our selection. Our professional parts people will even install your new wiper blades while you wait. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
You ever get that feeling, the walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Whether you need a battery for your truck, or a battery for your trail camera, or a specialized battery for your rangefinder, or a crazy toy that you bought for your kids, Interstate Batteries has got you covered. Stop into a local Interstate Battery retail store, talk with a specialist, get the battery that you need, and go on about your day. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
My name is Clay Newcomb, and I'm the host of the Bear Hunting Magazine podcast. I'll also be your host into the world of hunting, the icon of North American wilderness, the bear. We'll talk about tactics, gear, conservation, but we'll also bring you into some of the wildest country on the planet, chasing bear. Mike Yancey is a longtime bowyer and primitive archer. Mike is an expert in the field of making self bows. He also sells all types of supplies, primitive supplies for archery stuff. Mike teaches classes for primitive bows, making primitive bows, and Mike is a longtime trapper. And we have a very fun, information-filled conversation with my friend Mike Yancey of Pine Hollow Longbows. The Western Bear Foundation. These guys are fighting the good fight for conservationists, for hunters, and for bears out west. These guys are a nonprofit hunting conservation organization, and they're membership-driven, which means your membership adds mass to what they're doing. That's how they raise their money. They're good guys. Check out a membership with the Western Bear Foundation. It's going to be worth your time. DU Hunting Supply. Buddy Woodbury and his team, they are houndsmen and houndswomen. I have an alpha package from them with a TT15 collar, and this is a track and train system, which means it has the ability to track the dog, but it also has the ability to stimulate the dog for training purposes. You can get your alpha and your collar. You can also get all your other dog related needs. Whether you got a yard dog, a squirrel dog, a bear dog, a hog dog, a quail dog, a senile dog, whatever you need. If it's a dog, Buddy and DU Hunting Supply can help you. Check them out. Check them out on all their social media channels, and they have a podcast, the DU Hunting Supply podcast. Check them out. Man, tomorrow morning, I am leaving to go down to bait bears, and we're going to be using Northwoods bear products. I have used them for years and years. It creates an incredible scent attractant at all your baits. Even if you got quality bait, you need commercial scent if you're trying to make your energy and efforts the absolute best that they can be, okay? You don't have to have commercial sense to draw on a bear. Anybody would know that if they understand bears. But if you're going to go through the effort, and it is a lot of effort to bait a bear, might as well make it the best scenario possible. And that is to leave a loud scent footprint that's going to draw bears from further, that's going to attract more bears. And Northwoods Bear Products will do that for you. Check them out at northwoodsbearproducts.net. Bear Hunting Magazine, man, we're the only print bear hunting magazine in the world. If you want to support this podcast, what you could do is subscribe to Bear Hunting Magazine and check out all our cool merch. Our bear grease hats and bear hunter hats are probably some of our most popular. We have those now in First Light Fusion. Some of those were on back order. We're now getting those hats out and we're getting more in. So check out all our merch, hats, stickers, DVDs, patches, t-shirts, bear-hunting.com, subscription to the magazine. We got combo packages too, where you can get a subscription to the magazine, a hat, and a DVD. Lots of different options. Check it out. You're going to enjoy this podcast with my friend Mike Yancey.
They video everything. And those things, you know, they'll drop that much.
Yeah.
Lean back up. And you just feel like an idiot. You're sitting there like, how did I miss him that far? And then you see what he did. You know, they're not there.
Oh, man. Oh. Great. Well, Mike, I've got Mike Yancey with me. And Colby Moorhead, the bear tech's with us here too.
Yep.
Mike, how many times have you been to Africa? You were just telling a story about Africa.
Yeah, 3 weeks. I've been took a 2 week trip once, but I've been actually on safaris there twice.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. We were just talking about. I was telling Mike about how I'm moving back to the compound this year because I've focused on a trad bow so much. I don't know. It's not a particular reason. I just decided I was going to shoot the compound this year. But why that's relevant is Mike Yancey is, we've known each other for probably 10 years.
Longer than that now.
Yeah, probably so.
Yeah.
And, you're for sure one of the national experts on self bows.
Yes.
Making self bows, primitive archery. Mm-hmm. And so, like, if someone looked at me shooting a recurve and a laminated longbow and thought that I was a primitive hunter, Mike Yancey makes me look like I'm shooting a rifle with the technology and the kind of stuff you're using, Mike. But man, thanks for coming up here.
Oh, you're here.
You know, when I think about you, Mike, you're the real deal, man. Like, you're a wealth of knowledge. What you've chose to focus on, I mean, you're an expert inside of it. And I always appreciate having people like that in my repertoire of friends. I just have a ton of respect for you with all that you're doing. I mean, you've taken it to the bare bones of primitive archery all the way down to making bows, making your arrows, cutting, you know, turkey feather fletchings.
Sure.
Now, do you flint nap?
I can struggle along and make tools,
right,
but not hunting quality points.
Okay.
And that's one thing. I guess I was a butcher too long. I don't like getting cut.
Yeah.
And when I flint nap, I get cut. So
yeah.
I draw the line. And on my primitive deal, I kind of draw the line on string material.
Okay.
And arrowhead material. I want the very best
that
I
makes
can
sense.
Get. Yep. Mm-hmm. I'm very particular on that arrow flight, and I like modern shafts. I don't have a problem with guys that want to use carbons, even with a self bow. You know,
yeah,
they will work out of such a wide range of different bows.
Well, I like that philosophy. You know, to me, that if you're, you know, there's just certain sectors of anything we do that we decide what we value.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that you can make a self bow, which we'll describe what that is later.
Sure.
But then you can also say, well, hey, I'm not going to categorize my arrows in the same category as that. You know, find a way to make it limiting and enjoy it, but still make it an effective tool for hunting.
Has to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have to be ethical about it. There's some guys that even choose to shoot traditional that really probably shouldn't. You know, it's not a cool little thing that you want to do. It's a commitment to the effort that it involves. It's not a hindrance once you get to that point, you know, but you know the commitment. You've shot traditional for a lot of years, and it's a it's almost a way of life that once you get there, you know, it's a method hunt, you know, and I like that, but it's
I've never heard that terminology. What do you mean by I think I know, but tell me what you mean by method hunt.
You kind of go through the stages in your hunting, you know, where you you want to kill a bunch, you want to kill a big one, then you want to kill it with the method. And to me, I've been hung on that for so many years. I've put books, animals in a book. That's not that big a deal to me. I'm more shot selective than I am animal selective, but the method is what I like. I love reading about these old timers that we wouldn't be here today without them, and they had such a at their time, that was the only way to do it, probably, you know, in the flintlock guys, you know, in that era.
Yeah.
But just the different methods, and a guy will study the history, and you kind of become part, it becomes a bigger part of your hunt, especially when you make it yourself. You know, it's that method is a large part.
Yeah.
It makes it a year-round deal where if you really like bear hunting, there's nothing more fun than the method. I went through the self-bow deal where I wanted to kill them all with self-bows, and then I've killed them with recurve and then with flintlocks, and now it's, you know, it adds every animal that I hunt, that method is more important to me than the quality of the animal.
Right. That's a good descriptor. That's a good way to describe it. And, you know, really everybody's doing that at some level. Or not everybody, but most people. Because even with a compound, guys are choosing that over a more technologically advanced weapon.
Sure.
But you've just narrowed it down to just the core, you know, ultimate primitive method when you're using a self-bow.
Yep.
But, Mike, give me a little bit of history about yourself. You grew up right here in western Arkansas. Is that right?
Yes. Right on, within a mile of the Oklahoma line, right on Arkansas-Oklahoma line. And
Are you down there around where that Thomas Sparks buck was killed? Do you know the Arkansas state record that was the biggest typical in the southeast
that was
for
just,
like...
Yeah.
40 years.
That was out of Evansville, Natural Dam area. Just north of me a little ways. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. Those are the mountains that I hunt right there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's where I was raised. And we're fortunate in this area that we live here in Arkansas. We've got everything that a guy needs to make primitive bows. You know, this is the historical range of the Osage trees. And we've got Flint. We've got cane.
When Mike Yancey walked up to the global headquarters, he was walking up and I said, "Hey, Mike." And he was eyeing my Osage orange tree out here, man. He was wanting to cut it down. I could tell.
Yeah. It's a bad
typical
habit.
Bowyer. I was like, "Hey, man, I'm up here. Don't look at my trees."
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. I'm interrupting you, Mike.
No.
Tell me, okay, so you were raised here.
Yes.
Would you come from a hunting family?
Yeah, my dad hunted. He bow hunted a little bit when I was a kid, but he just, he never took it to the level that I did. I was just always fascinated with the arrowheads, you know, that you can find here. My grandma would find them in her garden and give them to me.
Yeah.
And that connection of finding those and wanting to learn how they made that stuff from the time I can remember. I had never shot a self-bow or even seen one until I made one and just started. I didn't have anything to compare to, you know.
Yeah.
The books were just kind of starting to come out on making those, and it got to be a big thing, you know, about 25 years ago. And now there's no secrets. Anybody can learn how to do it.
Yeah.
But that's what got me started, and then it just evolved into a business that has just been a way
of
life.
So you can trace back kind of the origins of this, of you liking primitive archery, to when you were a kid finding arrowheads.
Sure.
Really? So you picked that up as a kid. Did you have anybody, Mike, that interpreted that for you? Like, did you have a dad or grandpa or your grandma that maybe would have been like, "Wow, look at this arrowhead cut"? Because I say that because I find in my life that I trace back a lot of the things that I value to very small things that people I respected said. You know, like, because some people can pick up an arrowhead and just be like, "Oh, arrowhead."
Yeah.
I mean, like, I've had people give me arrowheads before, and I was like, "Why are you, this is an incredible thing. keep it for yourself.
You bet.
And I took the arrowhead because but the point was they had no value of it. But anyway, is that a fair question? Did you kind of come up with that on your own? Like, this is a valuable thing.
It was probably on my own. Like I say, my grandma always gave me those points and arrowheads and stuff that she found. But the fascination was there from the very first time. And I've got every one I've ever been given by her and the ones that I found over my lifetime. And the places that I hunt, it's amazing that I'll find stone tools or points, you know, when I'm hunting. It's just history repeating itself. And it's so neat to go to a place, you know, sometimes even in a different country, that you'll find tools that they're basically using the very same stuff that I am today. Just that connection is still there.
Yeah.
And that the mountain man era, the fur trade era, that fascinated me from the time I was, you know, 12, 13 years old, and it never left. You know, they settled this country, you know, and the bear hunters were a big part of that.
Yeah.
The trappers were a big part. So it's, I don't know, there's a deep connection there. Whether it goes back to ancestors, I don't know. It could be, but I've always had that an understanding of it. You know, it all made sense to me. It's not something that, you know, I couldn't work on a car for anything, but I understood how to make a gun and a bow. You know, it was easy for me.
Yeah. Mm. Do you have a pretty good stone point collection?
Oh, yeah, from the beginning of time to the more crude modern stuff, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
Is it all stuff you found, or do you buy stuff?
I never buy it, just find it. Yeah. And
really?
It's crazy how the earlier stuff is the better stuff. The further they went, the worse they got.
Really? Tell me what you mean by that.
The quality.
The quality. Like the points. Not the material, but like the technology?
No, just the
It's almost
like the craftsmanship and the effort that they put into them. It's like the older, earlier points, the craftsmanship and the quality was there, where the more modern they got, it's like they just quit relying on the craftsmanship and the quality's not there. They had the availability to the same materials.
Huh.
It's just less.
Have you
quality.
Ever found a Clovis point here in Arkansas?
I have. It's
really?
Not. They're fluted. I wouldn't actually call them Clovis. They're close, more like Dalton's that time period.
Okay.
But I've got several fluted points that I've found. So you're talking as old as they get when you're talking the fluted stuff.
So describe what a fluted head – describe what that means and about the time frame that would be.
Yeah, at least 6,000 years ago, but older than that. And it's a – when they made those points, they would take a way of percussioning a flute, a long flute that runs right down the whole length of the point. And they look crude, but that's the way they hafted them onto those atlatl.
So it's a longer point. And so a fluted point means that
it's kind of hollowed out in the center.
There was impact percussion that chipped off a big sliver vertically
down
on the point, as opposed to like horizontally. Like a lot of times you think about flint knapping, you think about hitting the point on the side, like chipping stuff off to the east and west.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Is that right?
Yeah, those are side notches. They did them on either on the side or the base, but on the Clovis, they weren't. They had that flute that run down both sides.
It narrowed down the point so that they could put it into a wooden shaft.
And not have such
a spear.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's what, those are some of the oldest, that's the oldest technology of stone points in North America.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Clovis, Dalton.
Yeah.
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 It's pretty incredible. You know, time is so deceptive because, like, we live in 2020 and we just think this is normal.
Yeah.
That you drove here from 50 miles away. You know, like, we just have this assumption. And it's amazing to me how easily we become, like, ungrateful is probably the wrong word, but like just take for granted what we have, because most of humanity, when you look at the time frame that humans have been on the earth, this is like a really short experiment where we have the technology that we have. I mean, most of mankind has been fed by stone points. I mean, especially with time. Now, considering the Earth now has almost 7 billion people, perhaps we're starting to, because the Earth population was so slim.
Mm.
Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, like,
sure.
But time-wise, most humans have been fed by stone points above agriculture, above what we've been doing for the last couple thousand years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And really last thousand years if we're talking about semi-modern technology. Anyway, incredible. It really is incredible stuff.
Yeah, we think we know it all now, but literally life as we know it didn't really exist till like the last 150 years. And then if you go back maybe even 300, they were doing just what we're talking about now. You know, it's not been that long in the scheme of things that life was like what we're talking about from the beginning of time till just the last few hundred years, things has really changed.
Why does this stuff fascinate us, Mike? Because everything you're saying, I mean, it's the same kind of stuff that I think fascinates a lot of us.
Mm-hmm.
And why, and I always ask people this, because I try to answer it for me.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it important? Because there's some people that would be like, you know, the past is the past.
Yeah.
What, you know, a lot of people, most people, maybe. But hunters would be a higher percentage of people that would value the past. But like, what... Mm-hmm. To you, what value does it have?
It's respect. I think it it involves the animals that we hunt, pursue. There's a level of respect there for them, not idolizing them, not worshiping them in any way. It's just it's a level of respect, you know. And it's I think the history of it and the method of it is, and animals are worthy of doing things the way it's always been done. And when you research all that and you have that connection with it, you can take a Matthews or a Hoyt and shoot golf ball size groups, you know, at 50 yards. And that is very good. And, you know, and you owe that to the animal, but, they're all just alike. They're cold as a fish, but you take a wood bow that you've made, you've cut the tree, everything came from your area or whatever. If you trade for it, it don't matter. The point is the level of commitment to the sport and the connection with it, and it all becomes alive almost. You're taking trees that were alive, you're cutting them and seasoning them, you're using rawhide, snake skins, whatever you want to use. It's all natural, it's all renewable, and there's a connection there with the commitment while you're doing it. Used to when I was a kid, I was making my own arrows, and you know, I'd sit there at the coffee table in the summertime and fletch arrows in the summertime. You know, it was just part of the hunt, you know. But when you go to that next level and start making your own stuff, it adds a whole different aspect to it. And I think a lot of people miss that that boat. And as outdoor riders, I think a lot of times we're our own worst enemy, because those big companies, they pay the bills, you know, and they are the ones that are advertising. My little company, you know, I do advertise, but as a whole, most of the primitive sports, they can't advertise. So
it's not big money. It's such a
small piece of the pie. It's a very small piece, and it always will be. So people are easily led by advertising. That they think to kill that deer or that bear, they have to have this camo, this bow, this gun. And they miss the fun. Things don't make you happy and things don't make you successful. It's your ability with that equipment. Not that there's anything wrong with those kinds of bows, you know.
Right.
I shot them for years too. You know, I went through a phase. I got rid of a recurve in the early 70s, late 70s, and started shooting a Bear Whitetail Hunter, one of the most crudest compounds ever made. But at the time, it was going to the moon. Yeah. I thought, boy, this is a ticket. And so for years, I killed a lot of stuff with compounds, but just went back to the old stuff and love it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, your first answer to why you're attracted to the old way was respect for the animal.
Mm-hmm.
As you said that, I was I'm kind of connecting that to kind of I recently read about how moose and elk and some of these really primitive ancestors of the modern big game that we have in North America, most of it, almost all of it, came across the Bering Strait during, you know, when the glaciers lowered sea level and there was a connection between Siberia and Alaska. And these animals came across, and at the same time, humans were coming across And one philosophy, one idea is that humans, you know, totally killed out the big megafauna, like the woolly mammoths, all the really big game. Because at that exact time that humans made it into North America, you know, 15, 17,000 years ago, all these big this big megafauna died off. But all the animals that had evolved with humans over in Siberia, they say had already, I mean, the human was a natural predator of those animals, and they had already adapted ways to survive human predation. Just like if you released a wolf predator into, you know, a sheep pen, and the sheep never had wolf predators, you'd knock them out. I'm connecting that back to you saying it's a respectful way to hunt, because like it really is like, you know, almost like a more natural method of human predation. Is it, you know, because it is quite unnatural for a predator to be able to attack game from 500 yards. I mean, like, there's nothing that can do that. But to be able to get within 20 yards, probably max, with a self bow, I mean, for most people,
yeah,
or even closer, is where you're at. Like, that, those animals have developed strategies to evade that close range predation. Anyway, I'm kind of just layering what you're saying, because I like that, but I was taking it back a step further to, like, why is it respectful to hunt that way, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that would be one connection point, is that it's we've been hunting that way a long, long time.
Sure.
So, just a thought.
Yep.
Yeah.
it's still effective. You know, a lot of people think, you know, they'll look at them at a show, you know, I'll have a table full of bows, and, you know, they think they're cute little toys. They don't realize how effective they are. And, you know, truthfully, you know, you've shot traditional for a long time, and you know what they can do. A good made self bow is within just a few feet of a good recurve, you know, or a good longbow, laminated glass bow. There's not that big of a disadvantage.
Okay. From a standard traditional
bow, to primitive, it's there's a very fine line. And in fact, some of the better made primitive bows are better than some of the low end production type glass bows.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Tell me, let's go ahead and define what a self bow is.
Sure. Most people consider it one piece of wood, you know, cut a tree, split it, and it's made from a piece of wood. They will still consider it a self bow with a sinew backing or a rawhide backing, and snake, of course. The snake's just for looks. It doesn't add any performance or durability. But some people even will consider a self bow laminated, like a board bow with a bamboo backing.
Okay.
Or that type of deal. I really don't. I think I consider that more of a composite. But a self bow would strictly be one piece of wood.
One piece of wood. So yep. Like stock removal. Like if you're starting out with a block and you're removing everything that's not a bow.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You're following those annual growth rings on the tree, the way it grew. You go through the sap and the bark, take all that off, and then you follow one continuous growth ring from end to end, and that's what keeps it from breaking. And then you start removing the thickness to get the poundage that you want.
Yeah.
And they've been doing it that way ever since they started making bows, and nothing has changed. They couldn't get it any better than they started out with. It's amazing. The different areas of the country, like the Western Plains Indians, they didn't have access to a lot of the woods that we did here in the South and the East and all of that. So their bows were shorter. Almost all of them were sinew-backed, where our bows were longer and unbacked because of our humidity. And then we had the availability of good wood. So longer's better if you can get it, but they couldn't. So there's different designs. And then like the Mongolians, you know, they about conquered the world with those little composite horn bows. But that's what they had available to them. You know, they were sinew, horn, and just a real thin little wood in the middle. But, you know, they could shoot forever with them, and they were very good. They, like I said, they about conquered the old world with them.
Yeah. So the self bows that you're making, is that a direct replication of Native American bows?
Used to be. I started out with the old Cherokee method.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, Al Heron, he is from Tahlequah, and his wife and him are both of the Cherokee Indians. He was trained by the old masters, and when he wrote his book, there was a big falling out. They didn't want, the old elders didn't want those methods passed on.
Oh, wow. Had
he not done it, it would have been lost. And in fact, the Cherokee Nation has sent a guy to me to teach him how to make bows so he could teach the Cherokee kids. Yeah, wow. So it would have been lost if Al hadn't have written that book. Hmm. And he's still alive. He's everybody owes him a big favor, you know, for doing that.
Do you know him?
Yes. Yeah, I've interviewed him on articles before.
Yeah.
And a great guy. Yeah. So, but that's the book that I learned from. And it's
what book is that?
It was called Cherokee Bows and Arrows.
Cherokee Bows and Arrows.
By Al
Heron. Do you sell it on your website?
I do.
Yeah, you know, I thought you did.
But it's a good method, and that's the one I started with, but then I developed a style of my own after that.
Okay. Well, tell me about that. What does that bow look like?
The Cherokee bows are long. They were big people. They had a long draw length, so most of them were, you know, in the high 60s as far as length, you know, probably even some 72-inch bows maybe. But
wow.
They're typically just a long, straight bow. No reflex added to them. They were just a straight, kind of a D-bow, what they would call them. And a lot of them even bent through the handle. But they did build a handle bow, which was very rare for the natives. Most of them didn't build a real rigid handle section.
So it just looked like the same consistency all the way through the
bow.
On
the D-bows that bent through the handle, they were just the same thickness all the way
so
through.
So no, like you would look at it and it just looked like a bent stick.
Right. But they did build handle bows, and that's what they were famous for.
What,
really.
Okay, what was their preferred wood?
Osage. Yeah, okay. Osage orange.
Is the Osage tree throughout the southeast?
Native in the Arkansas River Valley and the Red River Valley. That's where
well,
it's
now the
native.
Cherokees primarily came from
the Carolinas.
Yeah. Georgia. So what were they using back there?
Same.
That they were trading for it?
That and black locust. Yeah.
Is that right?
Yep.
So they were making self bows out of black locust.
Yep.
Is that, but it's not as good as Osage.
I don't like
orange.
It. It doesn't have the compression qualities that the Osage does.
What does that mean?
It'll crush on the belly. On the compression side, the side that's bending to you, it doesn't have enough strength. But you know, it'll make a bow. But right. I would do a lot of other things.
When did those tribes begin to have the technology to make a bow, a self bow?
I guess they always did.
Well, I've heard. I was thinking that you know, because they use atlatls. Mm-hmm. I was thinking it was like 2,500 years ago.
That they went from the atlatl to the bow?
Yeah.
That's probably about right.
25 to 3,500? Okay. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's. I'm not an expert on that. Somewhere in that range. So, I mean, there was a time period when all the tribes here were pretty much using atlatls and spears.
Yeah.
And then what's amazing to me is that all across the globe, kind of at the same time,
exactly,
everybody got this technology mm-hmm. of a stringed bow.
Yep.
Which is hard to imagine how news spread or how what do they call it? There's a term used to describe, and I think it's I can't remember, but where basically technologies spawn at the same time, but they're not connected, but it's just because of the technology beneath it. So you would look in like archaeological records and you'd think, well, these people had to have communicated, but they didn't. It's just that it was kind of this natural progression of just like human thought almost. Mm. I think it's called I can't remember what it was. Anyway.
Well, they've associated that with like Tesla and Edison with electricity. Both of those guys came up with that idea at the very same time, unbeknownst to each other.
Right.
And it's been all through history. And like you say, in the arrowhead type deal,
right?
They
convergent evolution, maybe what it's called.
Yeah, spontaneous knowledge, I guess. But they learned it. You're right. The points they made them all over the country at the same time, and I'm sure to a point they were in contact. Some is just a little slower, but even in Europe they were building. They're finding stuff that is just like ours at the same level of in archaeology they're digging stuff that was being done at the same time it was done here.
Right.
And it's nuts that all over the world they were doing the same things right. at the same time.
Right. So these Cherokee bows were made, they were a longer bow, mm-hmm. and then, let's see, is Osage Orange like the El Primo self-bow material?
To me it is. You can use some other woods, and like in the Pacific Northwest, they have Pacific Yew,
okay.
and the English longbows were famous for being made out of yew wood. And,
okay.
and it's good, but it doesn't have the durability and the ruggedness of Osage. You can throw an Osage bow out of a tree. You can go swimming with it. I mean, you can do – it's tough.
Golly.
And it will just last forever, especially with the grease finish. You can take some bear grease and beeswax and heat that wood till it won't suck up anymore. And I really think you could not wear it out if it's made right.
Really?
In a lifetime.
You just gave me a new usage for bear grease that I was unaware of.
I use it.
I'm adding it to the list.
I use it for used it for years. It's amazing.
Man, Osage, okay, when I built this house, this property has a ton of Osage Orange on it.
Oh, I see it.
It's secondary. I think this place was selectively cut 40, 50 years ago when this was just kind of, you know, farm country.
Mm-hmm.
And so they left all the junk trees, you know?
Yeah.
And around here, you do that, you're going to get some Osage Orange. When I built my house, the guy that was doing the footing, I've got a big Osage Orange right there and the one you were eyeing over there. And the guy said, "You're going to want to get rid of those." And I said, "Why?" And he just said, "Trust me, you're going to want to get rid of those." And I've got multiple Osage Orange stories. Number one, this tree's gotten so big that it overhangs my driveway, and all of my vehicles have dents in the hood mm-hmm. because of these, we call them horse apples,
right.
Osage Orange fruit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They're about as big as a softball and weigh about a pound and a half, mm-hmm. falling from 40 feet up, dead center of a hood, would leave a dent in it, number one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For years, I blamed my kids for bouncing a basketball. Really, the boys playing ball all the time, and I would have these dents in my hood, and I'd get upset with the boys, and then one day I was out there, and bam! So there's number one. Number two, that wood is so incredibly strong.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you... one time I was on my tractor, Mike, and I was digging something with the tractor, and I backed up, and that tree right there had an old limb that was only about 2 inches big that was hanging off, and I T-boned that limb right into the dead center of my shoulder blades mm-hmm. while I was on the tractor. And it was a dead limb.
Mm-hmm.
Any other limb would have broke. And I thought I was impaled. I was expecting to look down and see an Osage Orange sticking out the front of my chest.
Yeah.
And anyway, that stuff, it won't rot. I've got posts on this place, Osage Orange posts, that were here probably from the 40s, maybe 30s, that are still functional posts.
Right.
And that's why I cut down an Osage Orange, and I'm using it for posts out on my barn.
Yep.
Incredible stuff.
It is. Yeah.
Now, you go to Texas to get all your stuff, don't you?
No, I get most of it out of Missouri.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. But so you travel to get staves.
Mm-hmm. I actually have
staves.
Right. I actually have loggers that know what it is, and they can get more for it out of bow wood than they can for the oak that they're usually cutting for timber, you know. So
okay.
They'll grade it for me and select it, and I've got some pretty good loggers over the years that I've got a working relationship with that keep me in bow wood, and then I cut as much as I can, but the demand that I have, I can't physically cut enough myself. And that stuff like you're talking about being so tough, if you ever cut one commercially to get any number, you can take a limb that'll be as big around as a golf ball, and it will hang up on another tree, it won't break. The stuff will, and I mean,
it's just hard to handle.
You'll have to cut a half acre of trees to get one Osage to fall
yes.
because they'll hang and everything, and they just won't break. But it's amazing wood. But it's the best.
When you cut them with a chainsaw, you almost wouldn't believe. If you hadn't seen, if you didn't see it with your own eyes, you wouldn't believe it. But when you cut it with a chainsaw, it sprays a almost glowing chartreuse.
Mm-hmm.
Bright yellow sawdust.
Yep.
That's just incredible.
Yep.
They're beautiful. And then they, over time, quickly, they kind of turn that honey golden brown, but they go from a bright just yellow.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway, incredible wood.
Yeah, and you can't stop that from happening. It's going to...
Right, it's going to do
that. The light makes it change, and the more that bow or that wood is out in the sun, the darker it'll get.
Yeah.
And those that are finished with a grease finish, they seem to suck up those... I don't know if it's ultraviolet rays that causes it or what, but they tend to get darker faster.
Yeah.
And they really get a patina to them really quick that they age over, and almost like a slick gym floor finish after about a year of using that grease.
Yeah.
And that's just one treatment.
Yeah. I'll be darned.
Yep.
Tell me about your hunting with these self bows. What's your favorite thing to hunt with them?
You know, it changes all the time from what I hunted last, I guess, but for years it was turkeys, and then it went to antelope. I've killed a lot of antelope with these bows.
Wow.
I was fascinated with them. From the first time I went out west and seeing them out, you know, in the plains, they really fascinated me. But I've been fortunate to go from, you know, the Northwest Territories to South Africa and hunt everything in between.
What did you hunt up in Northwest Territories?
Caribou. Back in the end of the good days of caribou. I was glad I did it when I did.
Yeah.
And because the numbers aren't there now, you know. In fact, a lot of the caribou camps out of Yellowknife and on up towards the Arctic Circle, they're not even in business anymore. But yeah, took two really good bulls with an Osage self bow up there.
Wow.
And it's like hunting on the moon. You know, it's all tundra. Yeah. Nothing higher than a rock as big as, you know, you couldn't even hide behind. You know, it's amazing. No cover. And when I got there, I thought, boy, you can't do it. And, but I had a good Indian guide, and he knew their movement, but he didn't understand bows.
Mm.
And he asked me when I got out of the plane, he said, "Can you run?" I said, "Yeah, I can run." And we ran. Now, when those caribou would drop down in a drainage, we'd take off, and this was a big, tall Indian, and I mean, he could cover some country. we had a blast. Now, we chased caribou for a week, and like I say, killed two bulls with.
I'll be done. How close did you have to get to him?
One of them was about 40 yards further.
Is that right?
Further than I wanted, and that's where I say he didn't understand bows, because the bull was walking right at us. I was hiding behind a rock, and he was on the edge of a lake. He was going to walk right in front of me, and the thing's about 45 yards, and he starts yelling, "Shoot, shoot, shoot." And I didn't want to shoot that far, but the bull's standing there doing this, you know, and he knew we were there then, and I had to shoot him quartering to me at 40-something yards, and I put a Zwicky head, I was shooting Zwickies back then, right on the point of his shoulder and dropped him in his tracks. It went through, broke both shoulders and dropped him right there in his tracks.
Wow.
And he said he'd never seen a bow hunter do that. But it was, I was forced into the situation. It wasn't an ideal situation.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then the other bull, it was probably a 25-yard shot, and it was the last day. And he had always picked the locations, and when I spotted those three bulls, he almost like we knew this was it. He said, "Where do you want to get?" And I said, it was like a terrace of rocks where the glaciers had pushed up these terraces.
Huh.
And I said, "Right behind them rocks." And we went up there and got behind them, and they fed right by us. And when the last one came by, he was the biggest, and I just raised up and just thumped him at 25 yards.
Wow.
So it was cool.
See, that's further than what I would have thought. What range do you usually want game in?
You know, I want stuff 20 yards. I don't like it a whole lot closer.
Really?
You know, 15 is good, but 20, 15 to 20 is my perfect.
Okay.
But I killed a cow elk in New Mexico about 5 years ago, 44 yards.
I'll be darned.
And it was one of those deals where that's a little further than I like.
Yeah.
But they were coming down a trail. And there was a hole in that trail in the brush about the size of a 5-gallon bucket. And it was right at the trail. And the elk were just filtering through there. So I knew I was either going to kill it or hit the brush and miss it. So it's ethical. Yeah.
I see what you're saying.
And double lunger, you know, she went 40 yards, you know.
Wow.
So, you know, those are ideal situations. And I've killed whitetails, you know, in that range before. But these bows are so quiet. If they're feeding, they don't have a clue usually. Now, if they're standing there hunting boogers like we were talking earlier, and on that African stuff, that stuff is wired like you would not believe. And my bows are super quiet, but they can react so fast. So I try to shoot at stuff that's unaware. And because even at 15 yards on an animal that's aware, they're not going to be where they were when you turned loose.
Yeah.
So I lock them close.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's the most notable thing to me about shooting a self bow, from going even from my traditional bows or the compound bows, is how quiet they are.
Absolutely.
You feel like it's almost like shooting a gun with a silencer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you shoot a gun and boom, you the sound and everything translates into an equivalency of how dangerous that weapon is,
mm-hmm.
if I could say it that way. I mean, like, you shoot a gun and you're like, yeah, that would kill something.
Mm-hmm.
When you put a silencer on a gun and shoot it, all of a sudden it feels like a toy almost. It's mm-hmm. like, tut, 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 tut. And I've had that since. I feel the same thing when I shoot a self bow.
Yeah.
It's like, you shoot it and that air is flying fast and thuds the target, but you feel like nothing happened, you know, because I'm just used to thwack, thwack. And boy, you shoot a cell phone, it's just like,
right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that being said, most of the game that you shoot is reacting to the sound of the weapon. It's not so much the hit. I would almost bet most animals shot with a silencer or a suppressed rifle will die and fall quicker than those shot with one not.
Oh, for sure.
Mm-hmm. The impact is the same. The energy is the same. And the same thing with these bows.
Right.
I've literally shot stuff that I don't think knew that it was hit.
Mm-hmm.
I shot a black bear in Canada one time, and this was another one of those deals where I was forced into a long shot, and it was over 40 yards with the self bow, but it was the only bait that outfitter had that was active, and it was set up for a rifle hunter.
Oh, I see.
And I thought, well, maybe he'll wander by, you know, going to the bait, which was close to 45, 50 yards away. And I thought, yeah, I'm just wasting my time, but maybe he'll come under me going to the bait. Well, it didn't. It went right to the bait. And I had shot and shot that year. I was really ready. And it was so far away that arrow passed through that bear. It jumped back, like, looked around, walked off, and then turned around and came back to the bait and fell over dead. Never knew it was hit. It reacted to the arrow going on the ground,
yes,
you know, blowing through it, but it never heard the bow. Of course, that far away, you know, I don't think it would anyway, but
yeah,
it's amazing the quietness of these bows, and you get quicker recoveries. A lot of the stuff you see fall.
Yeah.
Where with a compound or a crossbow even, you know, they're so loud that they're running from that noise of the weapon rather than the impact of the shot.
Right, right. I've had the same experience with a traditional bow, a long bow that was pretty quiet, shot a bear, and he jumped at the sting, you know, and then just went back to feeding, just like, I don't even know what's happened here. Actually, that's happened multiple times now that I think about it.
Yeah.
And then they just drop over.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they don't. It slips through them so fast.
Good way to go.
Yeah, it sure is. What have you got big plans this year?
Well, I was supposed to have been in Africa, but that all got canceled with the virus stuff. But I'm going to New Mexico on an elk hunt here in a couple of weeks, so in October.
Yeah.
And then basically that's it for the rest of this year. Next year I've rescheduled Africa, and we'll go back there if things loosen back up. And then probably a moose hunt with Gavin and Eric. They've got a new moose outfit
up in Maine.
In Newfoundland.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, they've I've hunted their tribal land there.
And these are our buddies at Penobscot Outfitters. That's right.
Yeah.
In Maine.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
They have a good bear operation. They're hard workers, but they've got a new moose and bear operation in Newfoundland that has some pretty good numbers, so that ought to be good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hey, I'm going to look up your I want to look up your website here because I wanted to read off. Let's see. I want to read off what. I want to read off your web store. Okay, so you're Pine Hollow Longbows is who you are, and so this isn't a. I was just looking at this morning. Let's see. Native Supplies. Okay, Colby, how many people that you know have a website that, okay, I've gone to Pine Hollow Longbows and I'm on the Native Supplies. Okay, well, here we have buffalo horns for sale,
mm-hmm.
cow horns, deer toes,
mm-hmm.
for 50 cents a piece, full quill wild turkey tail feathers, We've got some napped arrowheads for $15. Stone Point blanks, stone knives, tanned badger fur, tanned beaver fur, tanned beaver tails, tanned bobcat fur, tanned coyote fur, tanned gray fox, tanned mink fur, muskrat fur, possum, otter, coon, turtle shells for $5 each.
Hmm.
Yep. Whole deer rawhide, whole deer, wild turkey barge, shoulder feathers. And all kind of turkey feathers. This is pretty cool. What are people doing with turtle shells?
Making Indian rattles out of them on the hand rattles.
Oh, is that right?
Some of it in the dance competitions, they'll stack them up on their legs and they rattle as they dance. And that's the same thing with the deer toes.
Really? That was my next question. Yeah, what are people doing with deer toes?
You would not believe the sound of a dried deer toe that rattles against itself. They have a sound.
Like a string of deer toes?
Yeah, they call it a bustle. And they'll put, I think, like 150 of them on there, and they drill a little hole through the tip of them, and it's just the outside of the toe, just the black part of the deer toe, and they look like little black bells. And on those in those dance competitions, there's different categories, and there's some that are historically correct, and they have some that are fancy. But when they put those deer toes on their outfits to dance, it's the coolest sound you ever heard. It's just,
I can imagine,
real neat. And we sell thousands of them.
I'll be darned.
For years, I've got a huge company that really has the niche for that business that I have supplied them for over 20 years.
So you're supplying the deer toes?
Yeah.
I'll be darned.
Yeah.
Where do you get deer toes?
Packing houses. Here, you know, they kill so many deer around here that that I've got a...
You have to have a special permitting to sell
I've got a letter of exemption from the Game and Fish Commission, because in their book it says that no part of the deer can be sold except for the antlers and the hide. And I'd been doing the sinew and the toes for years and years. And their lawyer, the guy that's in charge of all their legal terminology, sent me, he said, the reason for the wording of that was people were selling deer jerky. And they didn't want that. But he said, mine is considered an offal or a waste product, and there's nothing wrong with the sinew and the deer toe. So, but I kept that letter of exemption to just have on file, you know, in case it was ever brought up. But yeah.
So that makes total
sense.
That's
awesome.
Yeah. That makes total sense. Now, Mike, you also, tell me about your bow classes.
Oh, they're a blast, yeah. I do group classes, you know, usually one or two a year. Sometimes we'll do them on location and do a hunt in the evening and build bows in the morning. But most of the time they're at my shop here in Arkansas.
Yeah.
And I'll do one-on-one, and then I do the groups as well. The groups are okay if you like a crowd. And then you can get, if there's 10 guys in that class, you can get the problems that they will create. You can see how I fix them.
Yeah.
And you can get a little bit more hands-on by doing that, because usually somebody's going to mess up somewhere in the building and I have to fix it for them. So you can see how that's taken care of. On the one-on-one, you get more personal attention.
Yeah.
And I kind of control it where they don't have as much free time on their own, and usually there's not much to correct. But
yeah,
we do them at the class. And
so you got a one-on-one 2-day self-bow class that people could go on. You got a lot of different things here. You got you got scheduled for 2021 a spring self-bow building workshop.
Mm-hmm.
All this stuff's really affordable too when you think about how much you'd pay for a new bow. I mean,
you can get a bow cheaper in the class or in one of those instruction courses than you could have me build you one.
Yeah.
And then you get to do it. You can learn how to do it and get a bow.
Well, I mean, I'll just say what it is. $800 for a one-on-one class, two days with you, come to Arkansas and you're with them in a shop in your shop building a bow, and they come out with a bow.
With the bow and knowing how to do it.
Yep. Yeah, that's incredible.
Rather than paying me $1,200 to build them one.
Yeah.
But there's some that just don't want to build a bow, you know, and that's okay. But there's some that want to learn how.
Yeah.
And a lot of them just do it as a vacation. I have guys that don't even hunt that'll come take a class because it's they like to do things with their hands and they look at it as a craft and a getaway. So, you know, I don't care what they do with them.
Hey, this is pretty cool too, Colby.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm going to send you down here for a 5-day predator trapping course in the Ozark Mountains with Mike Yancey.
That'd be fun.
Yeah. So that you can come back up here and take care of all our predators on the estate here.
In the estate.
you have a predator trapping class in Texas and here.
Yeah.
That people can come to. And I mean, for somebody that's wanting to learn how to trap, man, golly.
That is an adventure now. Yeah, I mean, those are my favorite to do because they get to watch me trap. They learn how.
Yeah.
They get to see from start to finish, you know, how to do it, how to finish the hides, everything. And, you know, it's about as fun a vacation as a guy can take, and especially the Texas class, because we catch huge numbers of coyotes and cats.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd be exposed to more coyotes being caught in a 5-day class there than you would be on your own in several years. You know, we catch big numbers.
Yeah. Do you remember years ago, you're the one that taught me how to flesh coons. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
When I came down there and I had some coons and we fleshed a bear hide too.
Yeah.
That was a booger. It was in the summer.
Too hot.
It had been better in the wintertime when the fat was
gelled up.
Yeah. That hide turned out good though.
Yep.
Actually, you know what? Those bear hide chaps. You see those?
Yeah. That's the bear.
That's the bear.
Wow.
I took this raw bear hide down to Mike and we fleshed it, and it was in May. I remember when it was. It was in May and it was hot.
Very hot.
And the grease, and you know, it's best to do it when it's cool so that fat's a little bit more solid. Mm-hmm. And it was just a mess, but we did it, and we spread the hide out on a big sheet of plywood, salted it.
Mm-hmm.
I brought it back home and I left it on that plywood, stretched out, salted it multiple times, you know, it'd rake the greasy salt off every couple days, put more salt on.
Mm-hmm.
Finally got it to where the salt would stay dry after I put it on that hide. And then I sent it to, who did I send it to? USA Fox?
Yeah.
Is that who?
Probably so.
Is that?
Tannin Unlimited might have been back then. I was using them at one time, but USA Fox does them too.
Yeah.
But speaking of fleshing hides and stuff, stone knives, you would not believe how good a job you can do on a cape with a stone knife.
Mm.
Turning ears, you can't hardly cut them. But you can, that serrated edge on that knife, you can just zip, 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 zip.
Mm.
When I'm up there in Maine with Gavin and them on their hunts, I always have to take care of my bears there. And we'll spread those things out, and I'll take carry salt with me. And you can put that on there as you're doing it, and it helps you get a hold of it a little better. And then that stone knife will separate from the hide and the flesh. And there was a taxidermist there watching me do it one time, and he was just amazed that a stone knife blade will do better than a modern steel knife.
I'll be darned.
On fleshing and caping.
Hey, look at this. Somebody gave this to me. Evaluate the craftsmanship on this for me. I just handed Mike a knife, a stone point knife. It's got a deer handle, deer horn handle. It's got white tail sinew, and that's
pine pitch.
Pine pitch. Did he do a pretty good job?
Yeah, it's all percussion work. You can tell that.
He made that too. As my buddy down in Florida. He made that for me.
Yep, and you can touch these up. You can take like a horseshoe nail or a finishing nail, and you can just pop little tiny flakes right on that edge, and that thing will sharpen back up. But this right here would be perfect for fleshing a bear hide.
I'm amazed when people come in here. Sometimes I'll randomly pull this out when I'm opening up a box or doing something, and I'm amazed at how sharp it is. I mean, I've used this for quite a bit of stuff. Just around the office, just randomly for cutting stuff. I probably do need to sharpen it. That's a good idea.
It's easy to do. One of the bears that I killed in Canada one year, I kept the jaws, and I put an obsidian blade in one of the jaws and made a knife, and then went back the next year, and the bear that I killed the next year, I completely skint, gutted, and fleshed that whole bear with the bear-jawed knife from the bear that I'd killed the year before. So it just adds something to it. But it's effective. I mean, it will really work. I mean, it's amazing how good that stuff will work on a hide.
It is pretty incredible.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was gonna say this earlier, but just talking about primitive archery, traditional archery, when I first got into it, probably the thing that I had to become convinced of, and it was just lack of knowledge, lack of experience, was the effectiveness of them as a killing tool.
Absolutely. They'll do it.
I think I had been marketed to and just didn't understand that that this wooden weapon, you know, because in my upbringing would have been in the 90s. I mean, we grew up shooting archery tournaments and all that when I was a kid. And so everybody was big into speed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody was trying to shoot the fastest compound bow they could. And so that was the theme of the age, is speed is everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so you started seeing these guys that are shooting bows that were shooting 175 feet per second, as opposed to, you know, high 200s or even over 300 feet per second back in those days was smoking fast.
Mm-hmm.
And you get this idea that, well, golly, if speed kills, then 175 feet per second probably couldn't even kill a squirrel with it.
Yeah.
But that is the furthest thing from the truth. I mean, I've been amazed at, just as a traditional archer, I mean, I've killed a lot of bears with a trad bow, total pass-throughs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, very effective killing weapons.
Sure.
And just a unique and fun way to hunt, for sure.
Yep. To me, that speed just equals a flat trajectory. It takes the yardage guessing out of it for you.
Right.
And that is a huge plus.
Yeah.
But with these bows, like you say, one reason I went to hunting with them so much and left the compound, the hardest thing for me to leave the compound alone was for turkeys, because you can draw and hold so long and draw when you needed to and hold so long and let them walk into where you needed. And it was hard for me to give up that compound because I love to hunt turkeys with a bow.
Yeah.
But and the hardest thing for me to kill with the traditional bows were the turkeys.
Mm.
And it took me forever to get it done. And then once I did, I started killing them. But it's tough. But the main thing, most of the stuff you kill around here is going to be inside of 20 yards just because of our thickness. So, you know, that's traditional and primitive bow range. So I thought,
for sure,
you know, why not just go ahead and carry them? And then once you start doing it, then you just start falling in love with it. But that they've all got their place, and definitely a compound has its place in my book for turkeys, because I love to hunt with the bow.
Now, when you shoot your bow, are you holding? So you describe to me your shot process.
I'm almost a snap shooter.
Okay.
But I will anchor, but I lock into a spot before I ever start the draw. I don't do this aiming and moving around like you see a lot of these guys do. I cant the bow. My form is I point my left shoulder at what I'm shooting at, and I bend a little bit at the waist, and I lean my head in. But I have locked in my knuckle on my bow hand. I know where I want it on that animal, and I've picked the spot, and I lock into it right then. And if that animal moves, I've got to completely go through that process again, because my mind has already made up where I'm going to shoot. And if he
are you saying you're kind of gap shooting?
No, I don't gap, but it's a mental thing that my mind tells me where my bow hand needs to be in relationship to the target. So in a way, it is gap, but I'm not saying he's 12 yards, my knuckle needs to be down here at his feet. You know, it's not that. It's just from years of locking in total concentration. And it's purely instinctive, because I don't use the point of the arrow in any way to know to aim at. I'm conscious of the shaft. I'm lining up a point from the target to the tip of my arrow to the back of my arrow, and I try to get those three lines lined up mentally and physically. And then I come to I put my middle finger in the corner of my mouth, and I've already locked in on the
one
spot.
Finger over, two under.
Yes,
okay.
I shoot split. I cannot shoot three under with a tab. I just don't like it at all, and it makes the bows noisier. But for me, it just don't work. I just feel like I've got more control with the split grip like that. But and then I've locked in, and as soon as that middle finger comes to my mouth, that arrow's on its way, and I try to consciously follow through with the shot, not give into it, to look and see where it's going. I try to stay in that form till the arrow hits. And it's a big mental game. It's a huge mental game. And I saw that in Africa the last trip. It's so total focus, you know, that it's hard in a 3D tournament to shoot 18 targets or whatever and be very focused on every one of them. You know, it's you know you're going to hit it, you'll hit it. If you hope you're going to hit it, you usually don't.
Yeah.
So you've got to be it's as much mental, I believe, as it is physical.
Yes.
After a point.
Oh, yeah, I think so.
And
How did the Cherokees shoot?
I guess that they shot the same way. You know, okay. I don't know that they did any differently. You know, okay.
I know Ishii. He shot. You know, Ishii was the supposedly one of the last Native Americans in California that lived like Native Americans lived for 10,000 years, and he. He's the one that taught Saxton Pope and Art Young how to make self bows, and he was shooting like had a real odd grip with his thumb. He used the knuckle of his thumb, didn't he? Or how did he? Do you remember?
He had a pinch track grip, but he pulled to his chest.
That's right.
Most of those Western Indians did that because they were shooting shorter bows. They had a shorter draw length. They were shooting real stout, little short bows, and most of their arrows were probably only 22 inches. They were probably pulling them maybe 22, 24.
Imagine how you could be real accurate by. So what we're doing when we're shooting is we're pretty much drawing to a line. Almost directly. I mean, like when I shoot three fingers under, I'm almost putting the arrow underneath my eye. But split finger, the arrow is a little bit lower on your mouth, but still you're looking just right over the top of that arrow.
Yep.
And like Ishii, his anchor point was, you know, 8-9 inches below his eye, like down in his chest.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just can't imagine how they could have been accurate very far.
I think probably. And I can do that to a point with those little Indian bows, you know, playing with them. And there's days that you can just knock a ball all over the yard, and there's days that you couldn't hit a beach ball. You know, I mean, you just have good days and bad days when you're shooting that type of shot. But maybe they were closer. But on the Cherokees, I almost think they had their way of living, their way of shooting bows, their way of building bows was very European style, and I'm almost wondering if they didn't have some connection back then. You know, they lived in settlements, permanent housing, farmed, everything, and as far back as they can trace it. And the way they shot bows and the way they built bows was European style.
Yeah.
So it makes you wonder.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I think if you woke up every day and your only option for acquiring wild protein for your family was shooting a bow, you'd probably figure out a way to get real good at it. I mean, really, you think about the amount of effort that we put towards proficiency with a weapon. Even as serious bow hunters like you and I are, we really devote a pretty small amount of time. And, I mean, and there's people that practice way more than I do, I know for sure. But, I mean, like, if we woke up every day and that's the only way we were going to eat breakfast the next day was if we killed something and we were walking around with a bow in our hand all the time, every day, every day of the year, you'd probably get pretty good at whatever you did.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, you know, they would have, I mean, they were, you know, to say they were professional hunters is kind of a weird way to look at it, but they were.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how they made a living. And so they were, you know, I guess that's another way to try to understand how they could be pretty accurate shooting kind of what seems to us as an obscure, ineffective way, because we're trying to take this little narrow window of our life that we've dedicated to be archers, and we found, hey, if you draw it right to your eye, you can look that right down the arrow, and it can be pretty good.
Yeah.
That's something. Colby, what questions do you have? You've been too quiet.
A couple. What is there a bow in particular that you're most like proud of that you've made, like one that sticks out among others?
Yeah, I've got a couple. One is a Cherokee style bow that I made years ago. That's just a bear grease finish.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't even have a rest on it. I built it to shoot off your knuckle. I've since added a piece to it, but I've killed more deer with that bow than I have any bow I've gotten. It's as simple as you can get.
Yeah.
And then I came up with a design about, I don't know, 6 or 8 years ago, and I call it a deer slayer. And it's a form that I built. It's got... It reflexes at the handle and then deflexes a little bit and then reflexes back into the tips and I send you back it. Yeah. And those are a very good performer. They're really quiet. And that's the bow that I've been hunting with mostly the last several years. I've killed a lot of stuff in Africa with that model. And they've been really good bows.
Yeah.
Now, when you say send you back, describe that. I know what it is, but people may not.
What I use whitetail sinew mostly. The back strap sinew because that's I can get it. For years, I just used leg sinew, but it's a tendon, and it can be off a deer, elk, moose, it don't matter, buffalo. And you dry it, hammer it, process it, and then put it on by weight.
So that, it peels off in these
little
strips.
It's like a natural fiberglass. And then you glue it onto the bow, and it adds performance as well as durability. Because as that sinew shrinks, you put it on wet, and then it'll dry to the bow right there, and then it starts shrinking. Yeah. And then as it shrinks, it adds speed to the bow because it's already under tension.
Yeah. Golly. That's incredible stuff. It's incredible to think about. There was a time when humans didn't know how to do that, and there was a time when they did. And, like, what I wonder what process informed someone that, hey, you can take that
piece of that deer.
Chewy stuff. Because there would be no logical connection between that silver skin off of a backstrap, and everybody that's killed a deer and has processed a deer knows what we're talking about. I mean, it feels, I mean, like you could like cut it up and like chew it and eat it. I mean, like it's like, I mean, you wouldn't, but I mean, point is it's not like hard or something. It's not a bone. It's not even, it's not cartilage. It's just this... you know, just this super odd miracle substance that propped up mankind for a long time.
Yeah.
That's pretty incredible.
The Plains Indians relied on it because they had lesser quality wood, you know, and it will allow you, it's not a magic cure to bad quality wood or short wood, but it is in a way because it will allow you to use inferior quality wood that normally would not make a bow.
Okay.
And it will make a good bow. In the right climate. In our climate, where it's humid and wet, it's just mediocre. Out west, where it's dry, it is superior because you can take a juniper that will explode on you if you try to make a self bow out of it, but you can put a sinew back into that juniper and make a rocket launcher.
I'll be
darned. And it's amazing. And if it's tillered well, and that means if it's bending evenly and everything's right, that they'll last from now on, you know.
Do you think the Eastern Indians judge the Western Indians for using technology to their advantage?
Well, you know, they traded them Osage, so they wanted our wood. You know, that was a huge trade item, was the Osage stave.
What if they sit around the fire and made fun of the guys that you send you back wood?
Yeah.
Like, man, training wheels. Look at those boys over there. They don't.
Well, they made fun of because their bows were little. Look how little his bow is. Yeah, and ours were long.
Yeah. I bet they did, man. Sure I bet enough. They did.
Nothing's changed. It really hadn't.
That's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
That's pretty incredible.
Well, do you have anything that you still want to try that you haven't yet? Like, you've done all this stuff in the past and had all these challenges and things you worked through.
Insightful question.
Go ahead. Is there something, like, coming up that you would like to try or a challenge you would like to?
I still haven't got a moose killed with a bow, and I'll probably do that, and I still got a lot of African animals that I want to do, and I've got that all in the works. I'm working on a book right now, in the early stages of a book, and it's kind of an adventure-type deal of all the hunts that I've been on my life with these type of bows, and then I'm going to also incorporate the building of them, so it'll kind of, it'll give a little bit of the construction and try to pass on that challenge, you know. If a guy ever read that book, The History of Hunting in the Great Smoky Mountains, have you read that?
I've heard of it. I've seen it. I've never read it.
Those gun builders and bear hunters, they were characters. Now they they're a unique breed, and they hunted a lot of bears and stuff with those flintlock rifles that they built. Right. And that stuff fascinates me. So mm-hmm. I've got some stuff that I'm doing.
So
with
you
some
also flintlock rifles.
Yeah. I see the beauty in them just like I do a wood bow. I don't distinguish a kill with them any different than stuff that the bows that I've made with the guns that I made there.
Yeah.
The wood and iron is, it's pretty.
Yeah.
And they're, again, you know, we won some wars with them, you know. They started progressing, you know, towards the end of the beginning of the Civil War. They kind of went to the percussion guns, but before that, it was flintlocks, and they're very, very accurate. You know, 100-yard guns. You know, that's it. You know, but there's some guys that can shoot some of them a little further. But yeah, their weather might slow you down a little bit, but they're fast. People think that you shoot. Pull the trigger and that flint goes down and 2 minutes later the gun goes off. That's not the case, you know. When they're made right, they're very fast and effective.
Yeah.
So it's just a fun way to do it.
Bobby darn. Now you hunted you killed something last year with your flintlock, didn't you?
Let's see.
I'm just remembering you with or maybe you'd made a gun that you were gonna hunt with. Seems like it was last year, maybe not, but
yeah. I've killed a lot of stuff with them. I've killed black bears, with the flintlocks, lots of whitetails, turkeys, Rios, Easterns, and Merriams. I'd have a grand slam with a flintlock and a recurve if I could go to Florida and kill those turkeys. I hadn't killed an Osceola down there with a recurve or a flintlock, but I'd have a grand slam with that. So I like to mix it all up.
Yeah.
And the thing about it, with the flintlocks, I go back now and stuff that I've killed with bows, I'm going back and doing it again with the black powder. You know, so it gives you another reason to go somewhere and hunt again.
You feel like you're carrying a rifle, I guess. Well, and you are.
It does make it a little easier. Yeah, it increases my range a whole lot compared to a self bow.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's almost like cheating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, was it the bow making that got you into trapping?
The trapping got me into the bow making, really.
Oh, okay.
Yep. Yeah. I've missed one season since I was 13. I've got 40 some odd seasons of trapping that I was just fascinated with it from the time I was a little bitty kid, and it never left. And now, like I say, I get to travel different states. And that was always a goal when I was unable to do it because of work. You know, I couldn't get away long enough to go out of state and see if I could. There's guys that are really good at what they do where they're at.
Right.
But you get them somewhere else and they're like a fish out of their bowl, you know?
Yeah.
And I think trappers, if you will notice, are usually your best turkey hunters and a lot of times your best bear hunters and fishermen. They have a they can read, they notice things that most people don't notice. You know, they're just constantly aware of the surroundings because you're trying to make an animal put his foot in about a 4-inch circle and he's got thousands of acres to run in, and that bait's only going to work for so long, and it's just like bear baits. There's no magic bait or lure. You know, you got to be close and get it in the right spot to start with.
Yeah.
So it's there's a lot involved in that. That's something that I took a lot of pride in. You ask about the bows that I might like, but I think probably more so the ability to go somewhere else and be good at what you're doing, whether it be with a bow or trapping. It all kind of goes hand in hand. That once you master that trapping, it seems like everything else just falls into place, and you have an understanding of those animals and how everything's got a weakness too. And especially with trapping, you're trying to exploit that and know their habits, because there's things that you can do to get the odds in your favor to make him put his foot where you want it. And the ranches that I trap around here, those guys would probably cry if I quit coming, because they're seeing over the years now the increase of their game, you know, especially their turkey crops. And I think the coyotes are a lot bigger problem on the deer than people give them credit for, too. That the deer and turkeys are really making a difference. And I've got my foot in the door in some ranches in Texas now that it's almost more than I can handle to take care of those ranches there because of the demand for predator control.
I'll be darned.
And there's nothing more fun to me than to outsmart a coyote.
Yeah. That's a ton of fun.
It is.
Yeah. I'll be darned. Well, what's did you ever make much money trapping? I mean, like, Arkansas is not El Primo.
No,
fur density.
Yeah, it's not so much the density; it's the quality. And we're right on the very edge. If you get much past the tunnel, on very much further in my direction, the quality starts going down. Especially if you go south. Now, if you go west, it's still good, but we're on the very edge of still good quality fur.
Is that right?
Yes.
And even down to that, he's talking about the tunnel is where the interstate goes through, about 12 miles probably south of right here. So you're saying north of there, the fur is better.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a different, whole different ball game. But we're still on the edge of good fur. But yeah, as far as making money, the first year that I left the meat business and retired and did the bow business full time 9 years ago, my wife and I decided that we were gonna trap as hard as I ever wanted to, and the fur prices had been terrible since the 90s, and they didn't come back up. You know, they crashed.
Right.
And it just never came back up. And we were doing it just purely for fun and to be able to do it because that's what I wanted to do. And I hit it on – it was just the perfect storm. The market exploded, and I had a fur shed full of fur, and we actually sold $10,000 worth of fur that 1 year.
I'll be darned.
And it was good for another year or two after that.
And that's all just local trapping down here
in
Arkansas.
Yeah, then. But now, like I say, I'm doing other states.
Right.
But – the stuff that I'm catching out in Texas now, it's in North Texas, and it's as good a quality as a lot of the western states. You know,
really, for cats and
quality
and
wise,
coyotes.
Yes, you would not. It's like two different animals if you look at our bobcats compared to those.
Why?
North Texas fur quality?
But why?
I don't know if it's altitude, and some of it is they've adapted over the years to the terrain. Their spots are better than ours. You can even go.
So with a bobcat, a lot of it has to do with the
spots. Their location. Yeah.
Well, but the hide quality has to do with not just fur, but spots
on cats. Yeah.
Because people want spots.
Yes, and you can even go into parts of western Oklahoma, and their bobcats are way better than ours. These woodland bobcats are the worst in the world. They have terrible.
But what makes them worse? Spots.
The spots. The quality of spots.
Okay, so it's not fur density.
Not so much. But even out there in Texas...
Well, would it be that open country, more open country cats need better camouflage?
Absolutely. Yep.
Okay, well, that's it.
They're in that sage and in that open brush.
And they need more spots.
Yep, and they do have longer fur. It is more dense, but their quality of spots is way, way better.
And the fact that a bobcat is worth more when it has spots, it's totally a human... external characteristic that we desire.
That's the
for
demand
whatever.
They want.
So they're do you know where the bobcats are going and what they're doing with them?
Most of the market is like in Italy, Germany.
What are they making? Just women's garments
coats,
and stuff?
Yeah, vests and coats. Like the coyote trade, it's most of it is for trim parka collars and stuff, yes.
Yeah.
But the cats are still actually for like jackets and stuff like that and vests.
Wow.
Yep. And the Korea, China, when they're in Russia, because it's not just a luxury item, it's a necessity item because of their cold, cold winters, that they still wear a lot of fur every day because of needing it.
I've heard that's where a lot of coons and stuff go, is in Russia.
Yep.
Yeah.
And when their economies are bad, yeah, and when the Soviet economy's bad and the Asian markets are bad, the fur market's bad.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it'll all come back.
That year that you made or you sold $10,000 worth of hides, do you remember how many animals? And I'm interested in this because I live here and I'm just like, do you remember how many coons you caught, how many this you caught?
No, I don't. It was a lot of coons that year.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
I mean, would it have been like 100 coons or would it have been like 1,000 coons?
No, not like 1,000. No, it would have been in the 100 coons, you know, and on a mix of coyotes, bobcats, fox, you know, looking at 25 of each probably. And on the cats, maybe in Arkansas, I catch about 6 cats, bobcats a year.
Okay.
But you go out to Texas, you can catch that many a week.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's just the numbers. They're, I don't know what the deal is out there. Their densities are just ridiculous.
There's just more of them.
Yeah, and part of it might be because those places are so managed for deer, turkey, and quail that it brings them in because they've got a food source.
Yeah.
And that probably is a lot of the case because they're hanging around those feeders to ambush. Mm-hmm. So they kind of got a captive audience. But
yeah,
the West has always been known for having lots of coyotes. It just seems to be that way. They've got coyotes like we have coons.
Mm-hmm. You know, my buddy Jeff Lander told me a story, and I don't know if this is exactly the way it happened, but it's the way I remember it. And he shot a turkey over a feeder in Texas with a traditional bow. And as the turkey, like, fled from being shot with a bow, a bobcat jumped out of the woods. And Jeff, if I'll have to get the, and he felt like the bobcat was perched back in watching this turkey,
they
just
do.
Like him. He's over in a blind.
Yeah.
You know, anyway,
it's a learned behavior out there, and that's what we look for out there. They have limited roosting areas, and they're usually going to be in those branch bottoms where there's some big cottonwoods where they have roost trees. And those turkeys out west, they will – each gobbler kind of goes his direction with his little bunch of hens, you know, and they kind of go like wagon wheel routes that they've just – they do it every day. They're patternable, where ours are just wherever they're at that day. But those birds out there have a route that they'll kind of make a circle during the day. And you can find those ambush spots where those bobcats will ambush those turkeys in the brush. And that's what we're looking for out there, are those travel routes for the turkeys to ambush the bobcats when they're trying to catch the turkeys. Mm. It's just a, it's a neat deal.
Yeah, huh. That trapping class would be fun.
It really is. We start at daylight and don't get done skinning till dark. We check traps and set till an hour or so before dark, and then we're usually skinning till way after dark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's work, but it's exciting.
Yeah.
A lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would. Mike, where can people find you? How can people find you?
Best way is on the website, and it's just pinehollowlongbows.com.
Yeah.
And, of course, we got a Facebook, but, yeah, the website's easy. And like I say, we're a full-time business. It's not just a hobby. It's a hobby that turned into a full-time job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's a way of life. So I help people that's never built bows before, you know, every day on the phone. So I don't mind a little bit of helping along there. You know, I'm not going to build it for them, but, but I'm there for questions. That's one thing. When you buy a piece of wood from me, I'm not just for a one-time sale. I'm there to get you through the whole process and try to encourage you to get it done and go use it. That's what I want to see you do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's clear that you're really passionate about teaching and you enjoy that. And that's what it takes. I mean, that's what makes a good teacher, somebody that enjoys it and wants people to learn.
Yeah.
And, so yeah, that's great. And I don't think many people know that this kind of stuff exists. So, you know, you could learn more from you either in a trapping class or a bow class in just a short period of time than you could in years of personal research.
The bow class especially will save you, you know, most people can eventually club one out, you know, and get it done.
Yeah.
You might wreck your shoulder and never be able to shoot the rest of your life if you shot it for a year, but it'd sling an arrow, and that's what surprises me. People could literally cut a limb off one of these Osage trees you got in your yard and tie a haystring to it, and if it'll shoot an arrow across the yard, they're tickled to death, but they don't realize they can build an efficient, high performance weapon out of primitive materials. And that's where I can save them a lot of trial and error and breaking stuff.
Yeah.
In a short time.
Yeah. Great. Well, Mike, is there anything we hadn't talked about that you'd like to?
No, I think we pretty much covered it. Just don't limit your opportunities, man. There's so many things that a guy can do with not everybody can travel and go a lot of places. If their family's young, you know, they're kind of held tight. But like we were talking before we started this podcast, making one of these bows yourself and then going and hunting on your grandpa's place behind his barn or something and killing a white-tailed doe can be as big as any caribou hunt you ever went on in your life. And and literally they add up to, if I look back at the big hunts that I've been on, the preparation and the full circle completion of it is as important to me as the adventure or the exoticness of it. You know, Africa's yeah. great. It's target rich. But still, you know, killing something in Alabama with a bow that I made on a friend's ranch is as much fun as any big hunt, you know, you yeah. can do.
Yeah. No, that's a great point. And I think anybody that's hunted with any kind of a primitive weapon, they would get it because they've mm-hmm. done it themselves. But, you know, for me, traditional archery brought back kind of the initial excitement and love of archery that probably I had more when I was a kid, when I just got into it.
Absolutely.
And you know, we still have that same thrill, all of us that are passionate hunters, you know, that thrill of hunting, even the mundane parts of hunting, you know, that's why we are serious, is because we continue to enjoy it. It doesn't get old. But, man, hunting with primitive weapon takes something like hunting a doe in your backyard and turns it into an extremely exciting, extremely rewarding hunt.
It does. It puts that fire back in it. And on the flintlock stuff, you know, we all grew up hunting squirrels and learning how to be good in the woods and stuff. Most of us started on squirrels, you know, and that was our big thing when we were kids, to be able to do that. And I did that as a kid and then quit when I started deer hunting, you know, as I got older. But when I started making these flintlocks, I built a 36 Tennessee style rifle, and those little 36s are just like shooting a 22 Magnum that smokes. Mm-hmm. There's no kick, you know, mm-hmm. and they're deadly accurate. And it is my favorite thing to do right now is, as soon as the ticks get gone, is yeah. to go out with that 36 flintlock and shoot gray squirrels. You know, yeah. You're like a little kid again. I mean, coming in with a string of squirrels with the flintlock is much fun.
That's an achievement.
It's exciting.
That's an achievement.
That'd be awesome.
So have some fun.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's great. Well, thanks, Mike. I really appreciate it.
I've enjoyed it.
And I hope people check you out, check your website out, and just let it be an option for them to get into some primitive types of archery, flintlock. Yeah, Mike's a great resource for that. So thanks for coming up, man.
You're welcome. Enjoyed it.
Keep the wild places wild, because that's where the bears live.
You ever get that feeling, the walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins. Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate batteries. I use Interstate batteries in my boats. I use Interstate batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today.